New York City, March 18th, 2014. 9. Henry trails off as the realization dawns. He'd forgotten about B's attempt at finding a new thesis, one quiet detail mixed into a very loud season, but now it's obvious. The girl in the sketch, the painting, the sculpture, is leaning on the rail beside him, her face open in delight. They are walking through Chelsea on the way to the High Line, and he stops halfway through a crosswalk, realizing the obvious truth, the gleam of light, like a tear in his story. "It was you," he says. Addie flashes a dazzling smile. "It was." A car honks, the flashing sign gone solid in warning, and they run to the other side. "It's funny, though," she says as they climb the iron steps. "I didn't know about the second one. I remember sitting on that beach, remember the man with his easel up on the pier, but I never found the finished piece." Henry shakes his head. "I thought you couldn't leave a mark." "I can't," she says, looking up. "I can't hold a pen. I can't tell a story. I can't wield a weapon or make someone remember. But art," she says with a quieter smile, "art is about ideas, and ideas are wilder than memories. They're like weeds always finding their way up." "But no photographs, no film." Her expression falters just a fraction. "No," she says, the word a shape on her lips. And he feels bad for asking, for drawing her back to the bars of her curse instead of the gaps she's found between them. But then Addie straightens, lifts her chin, smiles with an almost defiant kind of joy. "But isn't it wonderful," she says, "to be an idea?" They reach the High Line just as a gust of wind blows through, the air still edged with winter, but instead of folding in against him, sheltering from the breeze, Addie leans into the wild gust, cheeks blushing with the cold, hair whipping around her face, and in that moment, he can see what every artist saw, what drew them to their pencils and their paint, this impossible, uncatchable girl. And even though he's safe, both feet firmly on the ground, Henry feels himself begin to fall. New York City, September 13th, 2013. 10. People talk a lot about home. "Home is where the heart is," they say. "There's no place like home. Too long away and you get homesick." Homesick. Henry knows that one is supposed to mean sick for home, not from it, but it still feels right. He loves his family, he does. He just doesn't always like them, doesn't like who he is around them. And yet, here he is, driving 90 minutes north, the city sinking behind him as a rented car hums under his hands. Henry knows he could take the train, it's certainly cheaper, but the truth is he likes driving. Or rather, he likes the white noise that comes with driving, the steady concreteness of going from here to there, the directions, the control. Most of all, he likes the inability to do anything else but drive, hands on the wheel, eyes on the road, music blaring through the speakers. He offered to give Muriel a ride, was secretly relieved when she said she was taking the train already, that David had gotten in that morning and would pick her up from the station, which means Henry will be the last one there. Henry is always somehow the last one there. The closer he gets to Newburgh, the more the weather changes in his head, a warning rumble on the surface, a storm rolling in. He takes a deep breath, bracing himself for a Strauss family dinner. He can picture it, the five of them sitting around the linen-covered table like an awkward Ashkenazi imitation of a Rockwell painting, a stiff tableau, his mother on one end, his father on the other, his siblings seated side by side across the table. David, the pillar, with his stern eyes and stiff posture. Muriel, the tornado, with her wild dark curls and constant energy. And Henry, the ghost, Even his name doesn't fit, not Jewish at all, but a nod to one of his father's oldest friends. At least they look the part of a family. A quick survey of the table, and one can easily pick out the echo of a cheek, a jaw, a brow. David wears his glasses just like Dad, perched at the end of his nose so the top line of the frames cuts across his gaze. Muriel smiles like Mom, open and easy, laughs like her too, head thrown back, the sound bright and full. Henry has his father's loose black curls, his mother's gray-green eyes, but something has been lost in the arrangement. He lacks one's steadiness and the other's joy. The set of his shoulders, the line of his mouth, these subtle things that always make him seem more like a guest in someone else's house. This is how the dinner will pass. His father and brother talking medicine, his mother and sister talking art, and Henry dreading the moment when the questions turn toward him. When his mother worries aloud about everything, and his father finds an excuse to use the word unmoored, and David reminds him that he's almost 30, and Muriel advises him to commit, really commit, as if their parents aren't still paying her cell phone bills. Henry turns off the freeway and feels the wind pick up in his ears, passes through the center of town and hears thunder in his skull, the static energy of tension. He knows he's late. He is always late. It has been the start of many quarrels, and there was a time when he thought it was carelessness on his part, before he realized it was some strange attempt at self-preservation, an intentional, albeit subconscious, dawdling, a delay of the inevitable, uncomfortable necessity of showing up, being seated at that table, boxed in by his siblings, positioned across from his parents like a criminal before a firing squad. So Henry is late, and when his father answers the door, he braces for the mention of timing, the chastising frown, the cutting remark on how his brother and sister always manage to arrive 5 minutes early. But his father only smiles.
"There you are," he says,
eyes bright and warm, and threaded with fog. Maybe this won't be like any other Strauss family dinner.
"Look who's here,"
calls his father, leading Henry into the study.
"Long time no see,"
says David, shaking his hand, because even though they live in the same city, hell, on the same subway line, the last time Henry saw his brother was here. On the first night of Hanukkah.
"Henry!"
A blur of dark curls, and then Muriel has thrown her arms around his neck. She kisses his cheek, leaving a smudge of coral lipstick he will later scrub off in the hall mirror. And nowhere between the study and the dining room does anyone comment on the length of his hair, which is always somehow too long, or the state of the sweater he's wearing, which is frayed, but also the most comfortable thing he owns. Not once does anyone tell him that he's too thin, or that he needs more sun, or that he looks tired, even though all of those usually precede the pointed remarks of how it can't be that hard to run a bookshop in Brooklyn. His mother comes out of the kitchen, tugging off a pair of oven mitts. She cups his face and smiles and tells him she's so happy he's there. Henry believes her.
"To the family," toasts his father when they sit down to eat. "Together again."
He feels like he's stepped into another version of his life, not ahead or behind, but sideways. One where his sister looks up to him and his brother doesn't look down, where his parents are proud and all the judgment has been sucked out of the air like smoke vented from a fire. He didn't realize how much connective tissue was made up of guilt. Without the weight of it, he feels dizzy and light, euphoric. There is no mention of Tabitha or the failed proposal, though of course the knowledge of their breakup has circulated, the outcome made obvious by the empty chair no one even tries to play off as a household tradition. Last month on the phone, when Henry told David about the ring, his brother wondered, almost absently, if he thought she would actually agree. Muriel never liked her, but Muriel never liked any of Henry's partners. Not because they were all too good for him, though she would have said that too, but simply because she found them boring, an extension of the way she felt about Henry himself.
Cable TV, that's what she sometimes called them. Better than watching paint dry, sure, but little more than reruns. The only one she even vaguely approved of was Robbie, and even then, Henry was sure it was mostly for the scandal it would cause if he ever brought him home. Only Muriel knows about Robbie, that he was ever more than a friend. It's the one secret that she's managed to keep. The whole dinner is so unnerving. David is warm, curious. Muriel is attentive and kind. His father listens to everything he says and seems genuinely interested. His mother tells him she's proud. "Of what?" he asks, genuinely confused, and she laughs as if it's a ridiculous question.
"Of you!"
The absence of judgment is jarring, a kind of existential vertigo. He tells them about running into Dean Melrose, waits for David to point out the obvious, that he's not qualified, waits for his father to ask him about the catch. His mother will go silent, while his sister will go loud, exclaiming that he changed directions for a reason and demanding to know the point of it all if he just crawls back. But none of that happens.
"Good," says his father. "They'd be lucky to have you," says his mother.
"You'd make a good teacher," says David.
Only Muriel offers a shadow of dissent.
"You were never happy there."
But there's no judgment in the words, only a fierce protectiveness. After dinner, everyone retreats to their respective corners, his mother to the kitchen, his father and brother to the study, his sister out into the night to look at stars and feel grounded, which is usually code for getting stoned. Henry goes into the kitchen to help his mother with the dishes.
"I'll wash you dry," she says, handing him a towel.
They find a pleasant rhythm, and then his mother clears her throat.
"I'm sorry about Tabitha,"
she says, her voice low, as if she knows the subject is taboo.
"I'm sorry you wasted so much time on her."
"It wasn't a waste," he says, even though it does kind of feel that way.
She rinses a plate.
"I just want you to be happy. You deserve to be happy."
Her eyes shine, and he's not sure if it's the strange frost or simply maternal tears.
"You're strong and smart and successful."
"I don't know about that," Henry says, drawing a plate. "I still feel like a disappointment."
"Don't talk like that," says his mother,
looking genuinely hurt. She cups his cheek.
"I love you, Henry, just as you are."
Her hand drops to the plate.
"Let me finish up," she says. "Go find your sister."
Henry knows exactly where she is. He steps out onto the back porch, sees Muriel sitting on the porch swing, smoking a joint, and looking out at the trees, striking a pensive pose. She always sits like that, as if waiting for someone to snap a photo. He has, once or twice, but it always looked too stiff, too framed. Trust Muriel to make a candid look staged. The boards creak a little under his feet now, and she smiles without looking up.
"Hey, Hen."
"How did you know it was me?" he asks, sinking down beside her.
"You have the lightest step,"
she says, passing him the joint. Henry takes a long drag, holds the smoke in his chest until he feels it in his head, a soft, buzzing blur. They pass the joint back and forth, studying their parents through the glass. Well, their parents and David, who trails behind their father, striking the exact same poses.
"So creepy,"
mutters Muriel.
"Uncanny, really."
She chuckles.
"Why don't we hang out more?"
"You're busy," he says, because it's kinder than reminding her they aren't really friends.
She leans her head against his shoulder.
"I always have time for you."
They smoke in silence until there's nothing left to smoke, and their mother calls out that it's time for dessert. Henry stands, his head swimming in a pleasant way.
"Mint?"
she asks, holding out a tin, but when he opens it, he sees the pile of little pink pills, umbrellas. He thinks of the rain pelting down, the stranger beside him, perfectly dry, and snaps the tin shut.
"No, thanks." They go back inside for dessert, spend the next hour talking about everything and nothing, and all of it is so nice, so aggressively pleasant, so mercifully free of snide remarks, petty squabbles, passive disapproval, that Henry feels like he's holding his breath, still holding on to the high, his lungs aching, but his heart happy. He rises, setting his coffee aside.
I should get going.
You could stay, offers his mom. And for the first time in 10 years, he's actually tempted, wonders what it would be like to wake up to this, the warmth, the ease, the feeling of family. But the truth is, the evening's been too perfect. He feels like he's walking that narrow line between a good buzz and a night on the bathroom floor, and he doesn't want anything to tip the balance.
I have to get back, he says. The shop opens at 10.
You work so hard, is a thing his mother has never said, a thing she apparently says now.
David grips his shoulder and looks at him with those mercifully clouded eyes and says,
I love you, Henry. I'm glad you're doing so well.
Muriel wraps her arms around his waist.
Don't be such a stranger.
His father follows him out to the car, and when Henry holds out his hand, his father pulls him in for a hug and says,
I'm proud of you, son.
And part of him wants to ask why, to bait, to test the limits of this spell, to press his father into faltering, but he can't bring himself to do it. He knows it's not real, not in the strictest sense, but he doesn't care. It still feels good. New York City, March 18th, 2014. 11. Laughter spills down from the High Line. Built along a defunct rail, the raised park runs down the western edge of Manhattan from 30th to 12th. It's normally a pleasant place, with food carts and gardens, tunnels and benches, winding paths and city views. Today, it is something else entirely. The artifact has consumed a stretch of the elevated rail, transformed it into a dreamlike jungle gym of color and light, a three-dimensional landscape of whimsy and wonder. At the entrance, a volunteer gives them colored rubber bands to wear around their wrists, a rainbow against their skin, each one providing access to a different piece of the exhibit. This will get you into the sky, she says, as if the works of art are rides at an amusement park. This will get you into voice. This will get you into memory. She smiles at Henry as she talks, her eyes a milky blue. But as they move through the carnival of free exhibits, the artists all turn to look at Addie. He may be a sun, but she is a shining comet, dragging their focus like burning meteors in her wake. Nearby, a guy sculpts pieces of cotton candy as if they were balloons, then hands out the edible works of art. Some of them are recognizable shapes. Here is a dog, here is a giraffe, here is a dragon, while others are abstract. Here is a sunset, here is a dream, here is nostalgia. To Henry, they all taste like sugar. Addie kisses him, and she tastes like sugar too. The green band gets them into memory, which turns out to be a sort of three-dimensional kaleidoscope made of colored glass, a sculpture that rises to every side and turns with every step. They hold on to each other as the world bends and writes and bends again around them, and neither says it, but both, he thinks, are happy to get out. The art spills into the space between the exhibits, a field of metal sunflowers, a pool of melted crayons, a curtain of water as thin as paper that leaves nothing but mist on his glasses, an iridescent shine on Addie's skin. The sky, it turns out, lives inside a tunnel. Made by a light artist, it's a series of interlocking rooms. From the outside, they don't look like much, the wood frames, shells of bare construction, little more than nail and stud. But inside, inside is everything. They move hand in hand so they won't lose each other, One space is glaringly bright, the next so dark the world seems to plunge away, and Addie shivers beside him, fingers tightening on Henry's arm. The next is pale with fog, like the inside of a cloud, and in the next, filaments as thin as rain rise and fall to every side. Henry runs his fingers through the field of drops, and they ring like chimes. The last room is filled with stars. It is a black chamber, identical to the one before it, only this time, 1,000 pinprick lights break through the obscurity, carving a Milky Way close enough to touch, a majesty of constellations. And even in the almost dark, Henry can see Addie's upturned face, the edges of her smile.
300 years, she whispers, and you can still find something new.
When they step out the other side, blinking in the afternoon light, she is already pulling him on, out of the sky and on to the next archway, the next set of doors, eager to discover whatever waits beyond. New York City, September 19th, 2013. 12. For once, Henry is early. Which he figures is better than being late, but he doesn't want to be too early because that's even worse, even weirder, and he needs to stop overthinking it. He smooths his shirt, checks his hair in the side of a parked car, and goes inside. The taqueria is bright and bustling, a concrete cavern of a place, with garage door windows and a food truck parked in the corner of the room, and it doesn't matter if he's early, because Vanessa is already inside. She's traded the barista apron for leggings and a print dress, and her blonde hair, which he's only seen pulled up, hangs in loose waves around her face, and when she sees him, she breaks into a smile. "I'm glad you called," she says. And Henry smiles back. "So am I." They order using slips of paper and those little pencils Henry hasn't seen since he played mini golf one time when he was 10, fingers brushing as she points to tacos and he fills them in. Their hands touch again over the chips, legs skimming beneath the metal table, and each time it's like a tiny burst of light inside his chest. And for once, he isn't talking himself in and out of every single line, isn't chiding himself for each and every move, isn't convincing himself that he has to say the right thing. There's no need to find the right words when there are no wrong ones. He doesn't have to lie, doesn't have to try, doesn't have to be anyone but himself, because he is enough. The food is great, but the place is noisy, voices echoing off high ceilings, and Henry cringes when someone scrapes their chair back over the concrete floor. "Sorry," he says. "I know it's not fancy." He picked the place, knows they probably should have just gone for drinks, but it's New York, and cocktails cost twice as much as food, and he can barely afford even this on a bookseller's wages. "Dude," she says, stirring an agua fresca, "I work in a coffee shop." "At least you get tips." Vanessa feigns shock. "What, they don't tip booksellers?" "Nope." "Not even when you recommend a good book?" He shakes his head. "That's a crime," she says. "You should put a jar on the counter." "What would I say?" He wraps his fingers on the table. "Books feed hungry minds. Tips feed the cat." Vanessa laughs, sudden and bright. "You're so funny."
"Am I?"
She sticks out her tongue. "Fishing for compliments, are we?"
"No," he says, "just curious. What do you see in me?"
Vanessa smiles, suddenly shy. "You're, well, it sounds cheesy, but you're exactly what I've been looking for."
"And what's that?" he asks.
If she said real, sensitive, thoughtful, he might have bought it, but she doesn't. She uses words like outgoing, funny, ambitious, and the more she talks about him, the thicker the frost in her eyes, the more it spreads, until he can barely make out the color beneath. And Henry wonders how she can see, but of course, she can't. That's the point. They're at the Merchant a week later, he and Bea and Robbie, three beers and a basket of fries between them.
How's Vanessa?
She asks, while Robbie looks pointedly into his drink.
She's fine, says Henry.
And she is. He is. They are.
Been seeing a lot of her.
Henry frowns. You're the one who told me to get Tabitha out of my system. Bea holds up her hands.
I know, I know.
It's new. You know how things are. She's
a carbon copy,
mumbles Robbie. Henry turns on him.
What was that?
He asks, annoyed.
Speak up. I know they taught you how to project.
Robbie takes a long swig of beer, looking miserable.
I'm just saying, she's a carbon copy of Tabby. Waifish, blonde, a female.
It's a long-running sore point between them, the fact that Henry isn't gay, that he's attracted to a person first and their gender second. Robbie cringes, but doesn't apologize.
Besides, says Henry, I didn't go after Vanessa. She picked me. She likes me.
Do you like her?
Asks Bea.
Of course, he says, a little too fast.
He likes her. And sure, he also likes that she likes him, the him that she sees, and there's a Venn diagram between those two, a place where they overlap. He's pretty sure he's safely in the shaded zone. He's not really using her, is he? At least he's not the only one being shallow. She's using him, too, painting someone else onto the canvas of her life. And if it's mutual, well, then it's not his fault, is it?
We just want you to be happy, Bea's saying. After all that's happened, just don't go too fast.
But for once, he's not the one who needs to slow down. Henry woke up that morning to chocolate chip pancakes and a glass of OJ, a little handwritten note on the counter beside the plate with a heart and a V. She slept over the last three nights, and each time she left something behind, a blouse, a pair of shoes, a toothbrush in the holder by the sink. His friends stare at him, pale fog still swirling through their eyes, and he knows that they care, knows they love him, knows they only want the best for him. They have to now, thanks to the deal.
Don't worry, he says, sipping his beer. I'll take it slow.
Henry?
He's half asleep when he feels her run a painted nail down his back. Weak gray light spills through the windows.
Hmm?
He says, rolling over. Vanessa's got her head on one hand, blonde hair spilling down over the pillow, and he wonders how long she was leaning like that, waiting for him to wake up before she finally intervened.
I need to tell you something.
She gazes at him, eyes frosted with that milky light. He is beginning to dread that shine, the pale smoke that follows him from face to face.
What is it?
He asks, rising onto one elbow.
What's wrong?
Nothing. I just...
She breaks into a smile.
I love you.
And the scary thing is, she sounds like she means it.
You don't have to say it back. I know it's soon. I just wanted you to know.
She nuzzles against him.
Are you sure?
He asks.
I mean, it's only been a week.
So what?
She says.
When you know, you know. And I know.
Henry swallows, kisses her temple.
I'm going to take a shower.
He stands under the hot water as long as he can, wondering what he's supposed to say to that, if and how he can convince Vanessa that it isn't love, it's just obsession. But of course, that isn't really true either. He made the deal. He made the terms. This is what he wanted. Isn't it? He cuts the water off, wraps the towel around his waist, and smells smoke. Not the scent of a match lighting a candle or something boiling over on the stove, but the char black smell of things that aren't supposed to be on fire and are now burning. Henry surges out into the hall and sees Vanessa in the kitchen, standing at the counter, a box of matches in one hand and the cardboard box of Tabitha's things burning in the sink.
"What are you doing?" he demands.
"You're holding on to the past," she says, striking another match and tossing it into the box. "Like, literally holding on. You've had this box as long as we've been together."
"I've only known you a week,"
he shouts, but she presses on. "And you deserve better. You deserve to be happy. You deserve to live in the present. This is a good thing. This is closure. This is..."
He knocks the matches from her hand and pushes her aside, reaching for the tap. The water hits the box in a sizzle, sending up a plume of smoke as it douses the flames.
"Vanessa," he says, gritting his teeth, "I need you to go."
"Like, home?"
"Like, go."
"Henry," she says, touching his arm, "what did I do wrong?" And he could point to the smoldering remains in the kitchen sink, or the fact it's all going way too fast, or the fact that when she looks at him, she sees someone else entirely. But instead, he just says,
"It's not you, it's me."
"No, it's not," she says, tears sliding down her face.
"I need some space, okay?"
"I'm sorry," she sobs, clinging to him. "I'm sorry. I love you." Her limbs are wrapped around his waist, head buried in his side, and for a second, he thinks he might have to physically pry her off.
"Vanessa, let go."
He guides her away, and she looks devastated, ruined. She looks the way he felt the night he made the deal, and it breaks his heart at the thought that she will walk out feeling that lost, that alone.
"I care about you," he says, gripping her shoulders. "I care about you, I do."
She brightens just a little, a wilting plant fed water.
"So you're not mad?"
Of course he's mad. "No, I'm not mad."
She buries her face in his front, and he strokes her hair.
"You care about me?"
"I do."
He untangles himself.
"I'll call you. I promise."
"You promise?"
she echoes as he helps her gather her things.
"I promise,"
he says as he leads her down the hall and out. The door shuts between them, and Henry sags back against it as the smoke alarm finally begins to ring. New York City, October 23rd, 2013. 13.
Movie night!
Robbie flings himself across Henry's sofa like a starfish, long limbs hanging off the back and sides. Bea rolls her eyes and shoves him over. "Make room." Henry plucks the bag from the microwave, bouncing it from hand to hand to avoid the steam. He dumps the popcorn into the bowl.
"What's the movie?"
he asks, rounding the corner.
"The Shining."
Henry groans. He's never been a fan of scary movies, but Robbie loves a reason to scream, treats the whole thing like another kind of performance, and it's his week to choose.
"It's Halloween," defends Robbie.
"It's the 23rd, says Henry,
but Robbie treats holidays the way he treats birthdays, stretching them from days into weeks and sometimes into seasons.
"Costume roll call," says B.
Dressing up, he thinks, is just like watching cartoons, something you enjoyed as a kid before it passes through the no man's land of teen angst, the ironic age of early 20s. And then, somehow, miraculously, it crosses back into the realm of the genuine, the nostalgic, a place reserved for wonder. Robbie strikes a pose from the sofa.
"Ziggy Stardust,"
he says, which makes sense. He spent the last several years working through Bowie's various incarnations. Last year, it was the Thin White Duke. Bea announces she's going as the Dread Pirate Roberts, pun intended, and Robbie reaches out and picks up a camera from Henry's coffee table, a vintage Nikon currently playing the part of paperweight. He cranes his head back and peers at Henry through the viewfinder upside down.
What about you?
Henry's always loved Halloween. Not the scary part, just the excuse to change, be someone else. Robbie says he should have just become an actor, that they get to play dress up all year round, but the thought of living life on stage makes him queasy. He's been Freddie Mercury and the Mad Hatter, Tuxedo Mask, and the Joker. But right now, he already feels like somebody else.
I'm already in costume, he says, gesturing at his usual black jeans, his narrow shirt. Can't you tell who I am?
Peter Parker? Ventures B.
A bookseller?
Harry Potter having a quarter-life crisis?
Henry laughs and shakes his head. B narrows her eyes.
You haven't picked anything yet, have you?
No, he admits, but I will.
Robbie is still fiddling with the camera. He turns it around, purses his lips, and snaps a photo. The camera gives a hollow click. There's no film. B plucks it from his hands.
Why don't you take more photos? She asks. You're really good.
Henry shrugs, unsure if she means it.
Maybe in another life, he says, handing each of them a beer.
But you still could, you know, she says. It's not too late.
Maybe, but if he started now, would the photos stand on their own, judged good or bad on their own merits? Or would each and every picture carry his wish forward? Would every person see the picture they wanted to see instead of the one he made? Would he ever trust them if they did? The movie starts, and Robbie insists on turning out all the lights, the three of them crammed together on the couch. They force Robbie to leave the bowl of popcorn on the table so he can't throw it at the first scary moment, so Henry doesn't have to pick up kernels after they're gone, and he spends the next hour averting his eyes every time the score whines in warning. When the boy rolls his tricycle down the hall, B mutters, "Nope, nope, nope," and Robbie sits forward, leaning into the scare, and Henry buries his face in his shoulder. The twin girls appear, hand in hand, and Robbie grabs Henry's leg. And when the moment passes, a lull in the fear, Robbie's hand is still resting on his thigh. And it's like a broken cup coming back together, the shattered edges lining up just right, which is, of course, wrong. Henry gets up, taking the empty popcorn bowl and heading for the kitchen. Robbie swings his leg up over the back of the sofa.
I'll help.
It's popcorn,
Henry says over his shoulder as he rounds the corner. He tears the plastic wrapper off, shakes the pouch.
I'm pretty sure I just put the bag in the microwave and pressed the button.
You always let it go too long, says Robbie, right behind him. Henry tosses the pouch into the microwave and swings the door shut. He presses start, turns back toward the door.
So now you're the popcorn pl-
He doesn't get a chance to finish before Robbie's mouth is on his. Henry sucks in a breath, surprised by the sudden kiss, but Robbie doesn't break away. He presses him back into the counter, hips into hips, fingers sliding along his jaw as the kiss deepens. And this is better than all the other nights. This is better than the attention of 100 strangers. This is the difference between a hotel bed and home. Robbie is hard against him, and Henry's chest aches with want, and it would be so easy to fall back into this, to return to the familiar warmth of his kiss, his body, the simple comfort of something real. But that's the problem. It was real. They were real. But like everything in Henry's life, it ended, failed. He breaks the kiss as the first kernels begin to pop.
I've been waiting weeks to do that,
whispers Robbie, his cheeks flushed, his eyes fever bright. But they're not clear. Fog winds through them, clouding the vivid blue. Henry lets out a shuddering breath, rubs his own eyes beneath his glasses. The popcorn rattles and pops, and Henry pulls Robbie into the hall, away from B and the horror movie score, and Robbie starts toward him again, thinking it's an invitation, but Henry puts his hand out, holding him back.
This is a mistake.
No, it's not, says Robbie. I love you. I always have.
And it sounds so honest, so real, Henry has to squeeze his eyes shut to focus.
Then why did you break up with me?
What? I don't know. You were different. We weren't a fit.
How?
Presses Henry.
You didn't know what you wanted.
I wanted you. I wanted you to be happy.
Robbie shakes his head.
It can't just be about the other person. You have to be someone too. You have to know who you are. Back then you didn't.
He smiles.
But now you do.
But that's just it.
He doesn't.
Henry has no idea who he is, and now neither does anyone else. He just feels lost. But this is the one road he won't take.
He and Robbie were friends before they were more. Friends again for years after Robbie called it off when Henry was still in love with him, and now it's reversed, and Robbie's going to have to find a way to move on, or at least find a way to smooth in love into love, the way Henry had done when it was him.
How long does it take to make popcorn? Shouts B.
A singed smell wafts from the microwave, and Henry pushes Robbie into the kitchen, hits the stop button, pulls the bag out. But he's too late. The popcorn is irretrievably burned. New York City, November 14th, 2013. 14. Thank God Brooklyn has so many coffee shops. Henry hasn't been back in to roast. Not since the Great Fire of 2013, as Robbie calls the whole Vanessa incident, with a little too much glee. He gets to the front of the line and orders a latte from a very nice guy named Patrick, who is mercifully straight, who looks at him with cloudy eyes, but only seems to see a perfect customer, someone friendly and brief and...
Henry?
His stomach drops, because he knows that voice, high and sweet, knows the way it bends around his name, and it is that night again, and he is down on one knee like a fool, and she says no.
You're great, you really are, but you're not.
He turns around, and there she is.
Tabitha.
Her hair has gotten a little longer, the bangs grown out into a sweep of blonde across her forehead, a curl against her cheek, and she stands with the easy grace of a dancer between poses. Henry hasn't seen her since that night, has managed, until now, to avoid her, to avoid this, and he wants to back away, to put as much distance between them as possible, but his legs refuse to move. She smiles at him, bright and warm. He remembers being in love with that smile, back when it felt like a victory every time he earned a glimpse. Now she simply hands it to him, brown eyes shrouded in fog.
I've missed you, she says. I've missed you so much.
I've missed you too, he says, because it is the truth. 2 years of a life together, replaced by a life apart, and there will always be an empty space in the shape of her.
I had a box of your things, he says, but there was a fire.
Oh, God. She touches his arm. Are you okay? Was anyone hurt?
No, no.
He shakes his head, thinking of Vanessa standing over the sink.
It was contained.
Tabitha sways into him.
Oh, good.
Up close, she smells like lilacs. It took a week for that scent to fade from his sheets, another for it to vanish from the sofa cushions, the shower towels. She leans into him. And it would be so easy to lean back, to give in to the same dangerous gravity that drew him to Robbie, the familiar pull of something loved and lost and then returned. But it isn't real. It isn't real.
Tabitha,
he says, guiding her back.
You ended things.
No, she shakes her head. I wasn't ready to take the next step. But I never wanted it to end. I love you, Henry.
And despite it all, he falters, because he believes her.
Or at least he believes that she believes herself, and that is worse because it still doesn't make it real.
Can't we try again? She asks.
Henry swallows and shakes his head. He wants to ask her what she sees, to understand the chasm between who he was and what she wanted, but he doesn't ask, because in the end, it doesn't matter. The fog twists across her vision, and he knows that whoever she sees, it isn't him. It never was. It never will be. So he lets her go. New York City, March 18th, 2014. 15. Henry and Addie offer up their rubber bands to the artifact, sacrificing one color at a time. For the purple band, they walk through puddles, inch-thick pools that ripple around their feet. Beneath the water, the ground is made of mirrors, shimmering, reflecting everyone and everything. Addie stares down at the ribbons of motion, the ripples fading, and if hers end a moment sooner than his, it is hard to say. For the yellow, they are guided into soundproof cubes the size of closets, ones that amplify the noise, and the others that seem to swallow every breath. It is a hall of mirrors if the bending surfaces warped a voice instead of a reflection. The first message tells them to whisper, the words stenciled on the wall in small black type, and when Addie whispers, "I have a secret," the words bend and loop and wrap around them. The next tells them to shout, this stenciled word as large as the wall it's written on. Henry can't bring himself to go above a small, self-conscious holler, but Addie draws a breath and roars, the way you would beneath a bridge if a train was going by, and something in the fearless freedom of it gives him air, and suddenly he is emptying his lungs, the sound guttural and broken, as wild as a scream. And Addie doesn't shrink away. She simply raises her voice, and together they shout themselves breathless. They scream themselves hoarse. They leave the cubes feeling dizzy and light. His lungs will hurt tomorrow, and it will be worth it. By the time they stumble out, sound rushing back into their ears, the sun is going down, and the clouds are on fire, one of those strange spring nights that casts an orange light on everything. They walk over to the nearest rail and look out at the city, the light reflecting on the buildings, streaking sunset across steel, and Henry pulls her back against him, kisses the crook of her neck, smiling into her collar. He is sugar high and a little drunk and happier than he has ever been. Addie is better than any little pink umbrella. She is better than strong whiskey on a cold night, better than anything he's felt in ages. When Henry is with her, time speeds up and it doesn't scare him. When he is with Addie, he feels alive and it doesn't hurt. She leans back against him as if he is the umbrella and she the one in need of shelter. And Henry holds his breath as if that will keep the sky aloft, as if that will keep the days from passing. As if that will keep it all from falling down. New York City, December 9th, 2013. 16. B always says returning to campus is like coming home. But it doesn't feel that way to Henry. Then again, he never felt at home, only a vague sense of dread, the eggshell-laden walk of someone constantly in danger of disappointing. And that's pretty much what he feels now, so maybe she's right after all.
"Mr. Strauss," says the dean, reaching across the desk, "I'm so glad you could make it."
They shake hands, and Henry lowers himself into the office chair, the same chair he sat in 3 years ago when Dean Melrose threatened to fail him if he didn't have the sense to leave. And now, you want to be enough.
"Sorry it took me so long," he says, but the dean waves away the apology.
You're a busy man, I'm sure.
Right, says Henry, shifting in his seat. His suit chafes. Too many months spent among mothballs in the back of the closet. He doesn't know what to do with his hands.
So, he says awkwardly, you said there was a position open in the theology school, but you didn't say if it was adjunct or an aide. It's tenure.
Henry stares at the salt and pepper man across the table and has to resist the urge to laugh in his face. A tenure track isn't just coveted, it's cutthroat. People spend years vying for those positions.
And you thought of me.
The moment I saw you in that cafe, says the dean with a fundraising smile.
You want to be whatever they want. The dean sits forward in his chair.
The question, Mr. Strauss, is simple. What do you want for yourself?
The words echo through his head, a terrible, reverberating symmetry. It's the same question Melrose asked that autumn day when he called Henry into his office 3 years into his PhD and told him it was over. On some level, Henry knew it was coming. He'd already transferred from the theological seminary into the broader religious studies program, focus sliding over and between themes that 100 people had already explored, unable to find new ground, unable to believe.
What do you want for yourself?
He'd asked, and Henry considered saying, my parents' pride, but that didn't seem like a good answer, so he'd said the next truest thing, that he honestly wasn't sure. That he'd blinked, and somehow years had gone by, and everyone else had carved their trenches, paved their paths, and he was still standing in a field, uncertain where to dig. The dean had listened and leaned his elbows on the table and told him that he was good, but good wasn't enough. Which meant, of course, he wasn't enough.
What do you want for yourself?
The dean asks now. And Henry still doesn't have any other answer.
I don't know.
And this is the part where the dean shakes his head, where he realizes that Henry Strauss is still as lost as ever. Only he doesn't, of course. He smiles and says,
that's okay. It's good to be open. But you do want to come back, don't you?
Henry is silent. He sits with the question. He always liked learning. Loved it, really. If he could have spent his whole life sitting in a lecture hall, taking notes, could have drifted from department to department, haunting different studies, soaking up language and history and art, maybe he would have felt full, happy. That's how he spent the first 2 years. And those first 2 years, he was happy. He had Bea and Robbie, and all he had to do was learn, build a foundation. It was the house, the one that he was supposed to build on top of that smooth surface. That was the problem. It was just so permanent. Choosing a class became choosing a discipline, and choosing a discipline became choosing a career, and choosing a career became choosing a life, and how was anyone supposed to do that when you only had one? But teaching might be a way to have what he wanted. Teaching is an extension of learning, a way to be a perpetual student. And yet,
I'm not qualified, sir.
You're an unconventional choice, the dean admits, but that doesn't mean you're the wrong one.
Except in this case, that's exactly what it means.
I don't have my doctorate.
The frost spreads into a sheen of ice across the dean's vision.
You have a fresh perspective.
Aren't there requirements?
There are, but there's a measure of latitude to account for different backgrounds.
I don't believe in God.
The words tumble out like stones, landing heavy on the desk between them. And Henry realizes, now that they're out, that they aren't entirely true. He doesn't know what he believes, hasn't for a long time, but it's hard to entirely discount the presence of a higher power when he recently sold his soul to a lower one. Henry realizes the room is still quiet. The dean looks at him for a long moment, and he thinks he's done it. He's broken through. But then Melrose leans forward and says in a measured tone,
I don't either.
He sits back.
Mr. Strauss, we are an academic institution, not a church. Dissent is at the heart of dissemination.
But that's the problem. No one will dissent. Henry looks at Dean Melrose and imagines seeing that same blind acceptance on the face of every faculty member, every teacher, every student, and feels ill. They'll look at him and see exactly what they want, who they want. And even if he comes across someone who wants to argue, who relishes conflict or debate, it won't be real. None of it will ever be real again. Across the table, the dean's eyes are a milky gray.
You can have anything you want, Mr. Strauss. Be anyone you want. And we'd like to have you here.
He stands, holds out his hand.
Think about it.
Henry says,
I will.
And he does. He thinks about it on the way across campus and on the subway, every station carrying him farther away from that life, the one that was and the one that wasn't. Thinks about it as he unlocks the store, shrugs out of the ill-fitting coat and flings it onto the nearest shelf, undoes the tie at his throat. Thinks about it as he feeds the cat and unpacks the latest box of books, gripping them until his fingers ache, but at least they're solid. They're real, and he can feel the storm clouds forming in his head, so he goes into the back room, finds the bottle of Meredith's whiskey, a few fingers worth left over from the day after his deal, and carries it back to the front of the store. It's not even noon, but Henry doesn't care. He pulls out the cork and fills a coffee cup as the customers filter in, waiting for someone to shoot him a dirty look, to shake their head in disapproval, or mutter something, or even leave. But they all just keep shopping, keep smiling, keep looking at Henry as if he can't do anything wrong. Finally, an off-duty cop comes in, and Henry doesn't even try to hide the bottle by the till. Instead, he looks straight at the man and takes a long drink from his cup, certain that he's breaking some law, either because of the open container or the public intoxication. But the cop only smiles and raises an imaginary glass.
Cheers, he says,
eyes frosting over as he speaks. Take a drink every time you hear a lie. You're a great cook, they say as you burn toast. You're so funny. You've never told a joke. You're so handsome, ambitious, successful, strong.
Are you drinking yet?
You're so charming, clever, sexy.
Drink.
So confident, so shy, so mysterious, so open. You are impossible, a paradox, a collection at odds. You are everything to everyone. The son they never had, the friend they always wanted, a generous stranger, a successful son, a perfect gentleman, a perfect partner, a perfect, perfect
drink.
They love your body, your abs, your laugh, the way you smell, the sound of your voice. They want you, not you. They need you, not you. They love you, not you. You are whoever they want you to be. You are more than enough because you are not real. You are perfect because you don't exist. Not you. Never you. They look at you and see whatever they want, because they don't see you at all.